We're going to go now to a launch that was happened during Refugee Week, which was for Aileen Crowe's book Acts of Cruelty, which is focuses on the experiences of people who have called for asylum in Australia when they've arrived by plane, and the poorest system that we have in Australia that undermines our credibility as a just nation. To begin, we hear from Suresh Sundaram, who is the Professor of Psychiatry at Monash University. He explains why he's at the launch, and after that we'll hear from Pamela Kerr, who was always also there. She is a long-term refugee advocate.
Welcome everyone to the Melbourne launch of Aileen Crowe's very important new book, Acts of Cruelty. My name is Suresh Sundaram. I'm the Chair and Head of Psychiatry at Monash University and have been in the asylum seeker space for about 18 years or so, so much less time than Aileen and some of the other people on the panel tonight, but in particular working around the health and mental health of asylum seekers and refugees, as well as providing advice to a whole list of organisations such as UNHCR and national governments and national and international human rights organisations. There are, from UNHCR estimates last month, mid-March, about 100 million displaced people globally. Of this, there are about 40 million children. Displaced persons can, of course, be anybody that's had to leave their home because of conflict, war, natural disaster, persecution. And of that, there's probably in the order of about 50 to 60 million. And another 40 million have had to cross a national border. In crossing a national border, your status changes. You go from being an internally displaced person to being an asylum seeker or refugee. For those of you who may not be familiar, all refugees were once asylum seekers, because an asylum seeker is someone who is seeking the protection of another country because they are unable or unwilling to return to their country of usual residence or birth, because they have a reasonable fear of being persecuted. To become a refugee, your fear of persecution must be for race, religion, nationality, or membership of a particular social or political party or group. The important points of that are that, of course, there are currently about 27 million refugees in the world. That includes people displaced recently from Ukraine and people displaced from Afghanistan. In addition to that, there are over 4.5 million people seeking asylum. To go from being a refugee, from an asylum seeker to being a refugee, you need to have been assessed by somebody. And that somebody can be an international agency like UNHCR, or it can be the authorised agency of a country, such as the Australian Department of Immigration. And you then need to have met the criteria defined in the Geneva Convention, the 1951 Convention, or the 67th Protocol, which is the expansion of the Convention, to those criteria that I mentioned before. But of course, you'd soon realise that there are many, many, many people who are persecuted for reasons that are not related to those factors that I've just mentioned. People persecuted for their gender identity, people persecuted for their sexual identity, people persecuted because of family violence, children and adults who are enslaved. There are a whole range of other reasons which are not covered under the standard Geneva Convention, and for which the United Nations has developed a range of other tools or instruments, conventions, treaties that cover a whole range of additional categories for which people can seek the protection of another country. Australia has a proud tradition of developing many of these instruments and of participating in their creation, including the 1951 Convention, when H.B. Evatt was a major contributor to the development, along with others. Australia is also a signatory to all of these conventions and treaties which protect people and which place an obligation upon signatory states to provide that protection for people who come asking. Australia differs from many of the other countries which we traditionally identify as host countries for refugees and asylum seekers. Countries such as the United States, Canada, countries in the European Union, because Australia has no Bill of Human Rights or Charter of Human Rights or any enshrinement within the Constitution that either says that we are obligated to adhere to these international treaties or conventions, or that we have any inherent need to respect the rights of others who are not Australian citizens or permanent residents. So as a consequence, although Australia may choose to oblige these conventions and treaties because it wants to be perceived as a good, solid global citizen, there's no legal compunction for it to do so. That's led, of course, to a very slippery slope. A slippery slope that sees Australia being able to wriggle in its adherence to the letter of the instrument rather than the spirit of the instrument. Australia takes currently 13,750 refugees from offshore places. These are people in camps, these are people who've been identified by UNHCR as requiring the most urgent protection. UNHCR lists about 200,000 people each year as the most vulnerable, the most endangered. It lists those 200,000 and not the 27 million because it knows it cannot find space for 27 million, but it thinks it can find space for 200,000. Based on those estimates, the current queue that people are going to seek to jump is in the order of about 135 years. The implication of that, of course, is that 13,750 out of 27 million is a tiny number. However, in the global scheme of things, it puts Australia usually about three or four in the world, behind the US, and thankfully the US again. There was a period of time, which some of you may remember, where the US reduced its intake to zero. Canada, which has been a generous taker of refugees, and then Australia. However, there's something that should strike you about the 200,000, because if there are 200,000 people being taken in each year, then what happens to the other 26.8 or 26.9 million refugees? Where are they? Well, they are in countries which, generally speaking, are adjacent to the source countries from where the refugees came. So, to give you recent examples, Poland has about 3 million Ukrainians living in it, which is about 1/12 of its population, give or take, or 1/13. That's about 6%. Lebanon has hosted 1 million Syrian refugees in a population of about 6 to 7 million. That's about 1/14. If you were to think if Australia was to host a similar number of refugees, it would need to take in the order of 4 to 5 million people. It takes 13,750. Other countries, such as Germany, which is, I think, been the par exemplar of a generous refugee policy under Angela Merkel, took in just over 1 million Syrians and others at the time of the conflict about 5 or 6 years ago. That's still 1 million out of 75 million, which is only about 1.3%. But it makes Australia and our neighbour New Zealand pale into insignificance. People don't wait 135 years in queues. People try and save themselves and try and save their families. They do desperate acts to try and reach places of safety and security where they believe that they will be afforded protection. Australia has a reputation of being a safe and generous country, and so people, knowing no better, came to seek the protection of Australia. They came in a variety of ways. They came by plane, and I'll come back to that because that's the central theme of Aileen's book, but they also came by other mechanisms. They came by boat, and they've come through undocumented mechanisms. There are estimated in Australia currently by the Refugee Council last year, somewhere between 90 to 100,000 undocumented migrants or people on vulnerable in a vulnerable status with regards to their visa. So that incorporates asylum seekers, it incorporates undocumented migrants, it incorporates others. Of those, approximately 40% are in Victoria, so give or take, about 40-odd thousand people in Victoria currently are in a vulnerable situation because of their visa. Of those people, somewhere around 30 to 40,000 people nationally are people who are asylum seekers who are seeking the protection of Australia. Many of those people were people who arrived by boat and who were then subjected to a series of policy and legislative changes which began in 2012 and which have continued up until today. Many of these people were placed in offshore regional processing centres on Manus Island in Papua New Guinea and Nauru, of the order of about 4,100. There are about 35,000 people who are seeking asylum, who arrived by boat, who've been told that they'll won't be permitted to settle in Australia, even though they might have been granted temporary protection visas. In addition to that, they are the people who are the subject of Aileen's book, and more importantly, the subject of Aileen's work over the last 2 to 3 decades. I can't underestimate the importance of her work with these cohorts of people.
I want to thank Aileen because this book is about the secret business that went on in the Immigration Department while the politicians were screaming about boats and detention centres and all the stuff that was going on. Meanwhile, we were trying to find out what was happening at the airports as people came through. And there were politicians who did ask questions, and they were damned hard to get the answers about how many people were turned away and what was going on at the gates. I only had a small window in that I'd get a phone call from the detention centre down the road and someone would say, there's a woman here crying, she needs to talk to you. Wasn't a lot of information. I went in, I met a woman. She'd flown in by plane. She'd come in on a visa for some sort of a sporting event. And then the story, she was a high-profile health provider. And there'd been a change of government. And the people in her office had disappeared. In fact, some of them had been murdered. And a colleague said to her, "You have to leave the country." She said, "I can't. I've got children." She said, "You take the children up the bush and give them to your family and you get out, or you'll have, your children will be orphans." She came in on a plane and she was questioned for 10 hours at Melbourne Airport. And I said to her, "Why do you think I was questioned?" She was sharp as a tack. She said, "I was the only black woman on the plane." Her story was one of many. She came in on a visa. She wanted to seek asylum. She had no choice. She was clever. She'd seen there was a sporting event. Sporting events, you know, in Australia, they're the Holy Grail. A lot of people come in, and she was going to apply for asylum. They gazumped her at the airport. They did not pass her through customs, which meant she went into detention. And she was there for 6 weeks, sitting in a television room one night, crying her eyes out, when this old Sri Lankan bloke, who'd been there for years and knew the ropes, he went over and said, "What's up? Why are you crying?" And she told him, "I don't know how I'm going to get out of this place. I keep asking them, can I speak to a lawyer? What am I going to do? I'm stuck here. No one will..." The immigration keeps saying, "Wait, wait, be patient." And that's why I got the call. And, of course, we could connect her up with legal assistance. Now, that came at a time in 2014 when the government removed legal... There was an automatic program called IAAS. IAAAS. I'm getting old, I forget. But everybody got legal assistance when they were put in detention. Then they got rid of it, of course, so they just let them lie there. And she was one of many cases, and they'd come in by plane. This was secret business that was going on at the airports. I can tell you there were Saudi girls who came in. Now, as you know, until recently, the law has changed. Now anyone over 18 doesn't have to have a letter from their male guardian authorising them to travel. But all through that time, they had to have this letter authorising their travel. And these Saudi girls were getting out for very obvious reasons. And I know that some Saudi girls told me they knew somebody had been turned back by border force. Can you imagine? Those bastards. So then the crunch came when this one evening I was called in to visit, and there was a man with his wife and three children from a Gulf state. He was very dignified and he clearly had come from some prosperous background. It turned out he was a poet, a writer, a soldier, and he'd been a representative in Geneva. And he said to me, in absolute disgust, we're sitting in the visits area. Some of you have visited detention. You know what it's like. It's pretty grim. And he said, "Pamela, this place is a prison. I visited camps for my country that were better equipped than this place." Now, he came in. He was on the amnesty rescue list. He was known. He made a big mistake. He got to the counter at immigration and he said, "Would you please direct me to where I can seek asylum?" You don't do that in Australia. You scurry through and you hope for the best. When I went to Rome, I was amazed to see a counter that said, "Anybody wishing to contact immigration, go to cubicle 5. My God, they're actually telling people how to go there. And then once I was in Indonesia, being deported, unfortunately, but we won't go into that. And there I stood in a queue and I watched this officer with a computer at the end of the Qantas area with two phones calling out the passports of every non-Anglo-Saxon looking person and double checking their documents to make sure that they had the appropriate visa to get on the plane to come to Australia. Yes, there's dirty business going on in this country, and thank God Eileen has written a book. It is complex, it's deep, because it's about the way in which the legal system has changed. That comment by Van Dusser is just so cutting, to think an Australian judge says, The legal decision is totally correct. The moral decision is reprehensible. It's chilling. But that is the state of things. But we've got a chance now. We've got a change of government. We know Labor are nervous around this area. Everybody, they've made it a political football, but we have hopes that there will be an end to some of this cruelty. And in the end, if we're really good at it, we'll end the cruelty once and for all.